10 disappearances, 1 common county. This is State of Missing. Welcome to Humboldt County. Hello, everyone. Welcome to 2022's first episode of State of Missing. I'm sorry that I'm late with the release of this episode, episode 34. But obviously, I got a little bit sick, which kind of prevented me from recording this episode sooner because my throat was real messed up and my voice was going in and out. So I couldn't record it any sooner than, you know, now, which means that we're on a late release for this episode. But I did tell you that we'd be coming back in 2022 with a big state, and we are here with a big state. We're gonna do California. And California is so big, in fact, that I'm going to break this episode up into 3 parts. And I'm gonna explain to you how and why I got to that conclusion. But let's go over the numbers a little bit just so that you'll understand why it is that we got there, okay? So in Namus, they have 2,951 listed missing persons, 1,081 females, 1,869 males, and one other or unknown. In the Charlie Project, there are 2,650 cases with 959 females, 1,688 males, and 3 unknown or other sexes. And on the Doe Network, we have 1,176 cases with 702 males and 474 females. So if you notice that those are really large numbers, and so obviously my normal method of going through every case and selecting which ones I wanted to cover was not really going to work here, because I'd have been going through these cases for months and I just didn't have the time for that. Instead, what I did end up doing is I found some cases that are connected. And not clearly connected, you'll understand what I mean when I get into it, but instead of covering a whole bunch of random cases, I found cases that are connected by location or some other means, and so each one of these three episodes that I'm going to release from California have a connection to a particular thing or place. Today, this part one episode, we're going to be covering Humboldt County, California. And if you're not familiar with Humboldt County, that's really odd. you might be familiar with Humboldt County and you just don't know that you're familiar with Humboldt County. If you subscribe to Netflix, if you watch Netflix, in December of 2018, Netflix released a docuseries called Murder Mountain. And Murder Mountain is related to Humboldt County. It's actually more specifically about the Emerald Triangle, but it has 6 episodes, and it's essentially about, you know, murders and disappearances in Humboldt County on Murder Mountain, and is all related, or mostly related, to the legal and illegal marijuana grow operations in that area. So the Emerald Triangle, as it is called, is consistent of 3 different counties in California: Humboldt County, Trinity County, and Mendocino County. And it is the largest cannabis producing region in the U.S. Now, obviously, marijuana is legal in California. For the most part, there are stipulations and rules you have to abide by if you are going to grow and sell marijuana there. But a lot of the grow operations, I say a lot, there's a large portion of grow operations in the Emerald Triangle that are still not legal grow operations. And people will protect their money, their income, their illegal grow operations by any means. So that's where a lot of those missing and murder cases come in this particular area. Because it's all about the grow operations in that specific area. Now, marijuana has been legal for medical use in California since 1996, but in November of 2016, they passed the law, Prop 64, that made recreational marijuana use legal. Now, 2016, that's recently. So a law before then, a lot of the grow operations were actually illegal. And now the ones that are legal for recreational use or medical use or whatever, they are still regulated. There are regulating entities in that area that, you know, make sure you have the right setup and licensing and all of that. So it is, what is legal is highly regulated. They are still like attempting to shut down illegal grow operations, which there are a lot of in that area. There's a high percent, actually. I don't remember exactly what the number is, but I do remember reading about it. I just don't remember what the number was exactly. So it's just a very... It's a very complicated situation there in the Emerald Triangle. With that being said, we're going to be covering 10 different cases in this episode. There were much more than 10 missing persons out of Humboldt County, but I handpicked these 10. I cut the list down and down and down until I ended up with 10. Now, I want you to understand that not all 10 of these cases are related to, you know, marijuana grow operations and whatnot, although some of them are. And you'll see when we get into them. A lot of these are just people who have disappeared or were last seen in this area or lived in this area and therefore were reported missing from this area. So it's not all to do with marijuana grow operations. So we're gonna get into a couple. I think I have a couple of those that are related actually to marijuana grow operations, but we'll see. And those are really interesting cases. I feel like they'd be a real big dig if you really got into it. So we're gonna kick it off today in Humboldt County with 10 cases. It's gonna be a long episode, so you know, make sure you're strapped in, ready to go. You might have to pause this episode, come back later to catch it all. But it's gonna be 10 episodes. I mean, I'm sorry, 10 cases, 10 really good cases that I handpicked. So we're just gonna get into it. Okay, so we're going to start Humboldt County out with an old case. I'm going to go in chronological order again this week. I don't know why I like to do that, and maybe it's just because I like to work from the oldest to the newest. But anyway, we're going to start out Humboldt County with an old case, but it is a very interesting case in my opinion. And while this case is so interesting, I could not find any other info about this case or the people involved anywhere online. The only two places I found anything about this case was the Charlie Project and Namus, where it is case number MP83728. So let's talk about the disappearance of Barbara Jo Kelly. Any of the physical details I have about Barbara come from the Charlie Project, but still the details are pretty minimal. We know Barbara is a Caucasian female. She was between 5'4" and 5'7", which is a pretty big difference in my opinion in height. For 5'4" to 5'7" is, you know, anyway. She was between 150 and 165 pounds. She was 17 at the time of her disappearance, although I don't have a date of birth for her. If my calculations are correct, she would be about 88 now. So we're talking about 1950 in this case, just so you understand and feel kind of the time period, which is also why, even though she was 17, there is no NCMEC number on her. So Barbara, who was a deeply religious person and lived in Fortuna, California, there she was a waitress at the Sweet Shop, which I do not believe is open anymore. I did look for it online, but I didn't find a place in Fortuna that is called the Sweet Shop that is open to this day. So it must have shut down at some point. But Barbara was like any attractive 17-year-old. She had, you know, gentleman callers. Actually, she had one that stood out particularly. She had a boyfriend named Henry Lawrence, or they called him Red Baird. He was 28, so quite a few years older than her, and he lived in Eureka, California. On June 17th of 1950, Barbara and Henry go out for the evening in Humboldt County. Barbara was never seen again. Do you want to make a guess how this is going to go? So, Barbara was never seen again. Yeah, right. Well, the following morning, a discovery is made on the beach at Table's Bluff. I think it's Table Bluff, not Table's Bluff. Anyway, Henry was found laying face down in the sand with a gunshot wound to the back of his head. He was naked except for his shoes and socks, which I think is honestly a bit weird. His clothes were nearby, though, but they were underneath, but underneath his clothes was Barbara's clothes, folded very neatly. The clothes were apparently positioned in such a way that they felt like her clothes were being hidden by his. But oddly, two articles of attire were missing from Barbara's clothes, her stockings and her shoes. There were no signs of Barbara, and they were unable to locate her. Of course, the running theory became that Barbara was abducted by whoever had, you know, killed Henry. So it seems like nothing really happened for a while in both the murder and the disappearance. Then in 1963, about 13 years later, things get a little interesting. That's when a possible suspect by the name of Gail Patrick Irish comes into light. Where did he come from, right? Well, he confessed to killing Henry, Barbara, and another man named Billy Wells Hale. At the time of this confession, Irish was already committed to a state mental hospital. I'm not exactly sure what, you know, precipitated this commitment, but I do know that apparently Irish had a long history with sex offenses. When he initially made the confession, it was actually a confession to the hospital chaplain. I will also mention, because it does play in this, that when Irish was arrested before he ended up in the mental hospital, that he was armed with a large caliber hunting rifle. Now, I said he also confessed to killing a man named Billy Hale. Billy Hale had been killed in 1957, so 7 years after Henry, but the circumstances were a little similar. So Billy Hale and a woman were parked on a lane 6 miles north of Marysville, California. While they were parked, a strange man, maybe Irish, walked up to the car and shot Billy Hale in the head. The stranger then bound the woman's hands and drove her for 16 miles. Then he finally pulled off of the road and into someone's private driveway. Fortunately for the woman, she was able to escape when the homeowner returned, despite being threatened with a razor. So he was threatening her with a razor. Now, according to Irish, he had found Barbara and Henry parked in a car on a remote road outside of Eureka. He said he ordered the couple out of the vehicle at gunpoint, and he said he forced Henry to take off all of his clothes and then marched him down to the beach where he shot him. He claimed he then drove Barbara to a logging camp near Cranel, California, where he shot her in the back. After killing her, he said he wrapped her naked body in a blanket and buried her off of a logging road there. Now, obviously, if they had found her, I probably wouldn't be telling you this story. He did try to lead authorities to where she was buried, and some of the specific logging roads that were named, and he mentioned, had actually existed, but 13 years had passed since he'd been out there, and the area had become overgrown and very heavily. So, that hunting rifle sounds like it could have been a win in terms of matching ballistics. Well, maybe. Well, not so much, because apparently police had misplaced that hunting rifle that they had confiscated from him. So therefore, they were unable to compare it to the bullet that was taken from the scene of Henry's murder. So guess what all of this means? Irish was never charged with any of the murders he confessed to due to lack of evidence. So Henry's murder and Barbara's disappearance and presumed murder, as well as Billy Hale's murder, remains unsolved. So what do we think here? Did Irish do it, or is he just, you know, crazy? What I think is a possibility, an option, although I don't think it's very likely, is, you know, that Barbara could have killed Henry and walked off. I don't think that's what happened, but it certainly could be a possibility. So if you have any information that can help solve any of these cases, or maybe if you know where that hunting rifle is, you should contact Humboldt County Sheriff's Office. So we're going to move right into a pretty sad case. This is a triple disappearance, the disappearance of the Storts. This is a disappearance of a mother and her two daughters. It's going to be a lot of physical details to get through, but I'm going to go in order of age. So I'll start with the mother, Mary. Mary Elizabeth Stort is case number MP10151 in Namus and case number 2839 DFCA in the Doe Network. She's a Caucasian female born on April 25th of 1945. She was 32 at the time of her disappearance, and she would be 76 now. She stood at 5'5" and weighed 135 pounds. She has brown hair and blue eyes, and her maiden name is Dankert. Jesse Flo Stort is case number MP6698 in Namus and case number 2773 DFCA in the Doe Network. Fanny and her sister Jesse share the NCMEC number of 604549. Jessie is also a Caucasian female. She does not have a date of birth listed, but she was 2 at the time of her disappearance, and she would be 46 now. She stood at 2'8" and weighed 26 pounds. She has blonde hair and hazel eyes. Fanny Fawn Stort is case number MP6699 in Namus and case number 2774 DFCA in the Doe Network. She too is a Caucasian female. I do not have a date of birth on her, but she was 1 at the time of her disappearance, and she would be about 45 now. She stood at 2'4" and weighed only 20 pounds, and Fanny has red hair and hazel eyes. So let's get into this. Mary was married to a man named Byron McCrae Stort. Together they had Jesse and Fanny. Mary also had an older daughter from a previous relationship, but she isn't often mentioned, and I don't believe she plays into this case very much. So Byron was apparently a man who was quick to anger and not afraid of violence. That's how he's often described. I never really like when our stories kind of start off this way, because generally that you know what that means. On Saturday, December 10th of 1977, Mary loads Jesse and Fanny up into her red Opel station wagon to go run some errands. They left their house in Honeydew, California around 10 a.m. They were planning on going to a television repair shop in Eureka or Fairfield and to an optometrist as well as the grocery store. They should have been home by dark, but they were actually never seen again. When they didn't return, Byron didn't report them missing. The girls weren't reported missing until the following Tuesday, and it wasn't Byron that made that report. It was a friend of Mary that filed the report and sparked the search for the girls in the surrounding areas. On January 19th, of 1978, a little over a month after they were last seen, the red station wagon was found on an old logging road only a few miles away from their home. The car's gas line was busted, and there were also groceries in the back, so they had made it to the grocery store, apparently. There was no evidence of foul play or a struggle in or around the car, and there was also no indication of the girls' whereabouts based on the vehicle. Now, like you, police looked at Byron, because he, or the man, is always the first suspect. The ones closest are always the first suspects. They knew about his bad temper and his violent history, so, I mean, of course, you know, he's the first person they want to talk to. Not just that, but after the disappearance, Byron had acted really strangely. He began abusing drugs and alcohol, and when he was asked, he said his wife and children had been abducted by aliens. In 1991, Byron was diagnosed with AIDS. After his diagnosis, he got clean from drugs and alcohol. He even became a local activist for AIDS sufferers. In 1996, at the age of 48, Byron died from hepatitis. He had never remarried or had any more children. In his obituary, though, there is a mention of a girlfriend, but nothing about his wife Mary or his children. Even in his sobriety, Byron never provided information about what may have happened to the girls, and they weren't even mentioned at all in his life after, you know, they disappeared, especially in his obituary when he did pass. In 2009, the case is reopened, and at that point, they began speaking to and interviewing people that they hadn't spoke to before. At that point, they named Byron as the primary suspect in his wife and daughter's disappearances. Doesn't do a whole lot of good, though, because Byron had already died, and they never even had evidence to charge him when he was alive. So, I don't know if they... I'm sure they don't have enough evidence to charge him now, if they could, after he's already deceased. They do say, though, that they believed others may have been involved with the disappearance, and they ask anyone with information to come forward. They shift the investigation at that point to trying to locate the bodies of the girls. They are attempting to locate a burial site in the Honeydew region. I don't know why or when they started to believe that they were buried there, but some clues must have led them to that conclusion, obviously, because that's the point that they're focused on. Mary's oldest daughter keeps in contact with investigators about her mother and sister's disappearances. So if you can help her finally get closure about what happened to them on December 10th of 1977, please contact the Humboldt County District Attorney's Office. This next case is going to be a pretty short one. Not a lot to say about the disappearance, really. Let's talk about John Stuart Campbell. He is case number MP21713 in Namus and case number 277 DMCA in the Doe Network. John is a Caucasian male, born on September 21st of 1966. He was 18 at the time of his disappearance, and he would be 55 now. He is between 5'11" and 6' tall and weighs 160 pounds. He was last seen wearing a knee-length gray-green colored trench coat, and he should have been carrying his wallet. He has blonde hair and blue eyes. He has freckles and face discoloration. He has light-colored skin on his neck near his left shoulder. Apparently, he's circumcised. That's the first time I've run across that descriptor. His name is Jonathan, and allegedly, he was depressed at the time of his disappearance. Oh, his nickname is Jonathan. I'm sorry. In 1985, John was a student at Humboldt State University in Arcata, California. John was last seen on campus on February 16th of 85 and has never been seen again. His residence hall advisor is the person who reported him missing, but I don't know how long after February 16th the report was actually made. After John's disappearance, a park ranger found his vehicle in a wilderness area. They say there was no sign of robbery, but they don't say if there was a sign of a struggle. They do say he disappeared under suspicious circumstances, and they believe he may have been taken against his will. John has, however, been known to frequent camping and or recreational areas. So if you know anything about the whereabouts of John Campbell, you can contact the Humboldt State University Police Department. So the next case we're going to talk about may be a little familiar to some people. This case is one piece of a much bigger puzzle. I'm going to try to tell this case in a concise manner, but because there are so many connecting pieces, it may be a little difficult. So let's get into the disappearance of Karen Marie Mitchell. She is case number MP6411 in Namus and case number 1863DFCA in the Doe Network. She was a juvenile, so her NCMEC is 840753. Karen is a Caucasian female with sandy brown neck-length hair and blue-green colored eyes. She was born on November 30th of 1980, and she was 16 at the time of her disappearance. She would be 41 now. She is 5'5" and 130 pounds. She was last seen wearing a long-sleeved tan shirt, baggy dark brown corduroy pants, tan leather buckled shoes, small hoop earrings, 3 silver rings, and a silver necklace with a crystal. She was also carrying a Nalgene water bottle. I think it's Nalgene. So let me tell you a little bit about who Karen was. Karen's parents divorced shortly after Karen was born, and Karen was raised by her mother, Mary Casper, along with Karen's brother in Orange County. Karen grew up and began having strong views about the environment. At the age of 13, Karen moved in with her aunt and uncle in Eureka, and this was because they thought living in Eureka was better for her environmental views. In Humboldt County, Karen developed a pretty good life. She had made a best friend named Megan, and at 16 in 1997, Karen was passionate about politics, the environment, and children. She also had liberal views. She was also determined to graduate high school early and at 16 so she could start college sooner. She was looking into Humboldt State University and was only a semester away from graduating. She was wanting to study environmental sciences in college. Now let's talk about November 25th of 1997. On that morning, Karen spent most of the morning working on a school project, and the project required Karen to call several family members. One of those family members included her mother, Mary, so she used the opportunity to catch up with her mom. They talked about their Christmas plans because Karen was planning on visiting Orange County for Christmas, and then they talked about summer plans. Karen and Mary were talking about taking some college courses together. All morning, the mother and daughter pair got involved in filling out paperwork to start applying for college, like filling out the FAFSA forms. Now, because this was Thanksgiving break, Karen was helping her aunt out at her shoe store. It was called Annie's Shoes. After speaking to her mom, Karen went over to the shoe store. And this wasn't her only job, so Karen was working at a daycare center as well. So when it was time for her to head over to that job, Karen's aunt asked her if she needed a ride. Karen declined the offer because it was a nice sunny day out and the walk to the daycare was only about a mile away. At the end of the workday, Karen's aunt headed over to the Coastal Family Development Center to pick up Karen. She normally did this, and she usually just sit out in front of the windows and watch as Karen closed up. But on this day, Annie pulled up to the daycare, and the lights were already off. She spoke to the staff that was still there and discovered that Karen never showed up for work on this day. This was extremely abnormal because she had never missed a day of work until this day. Karen was pretty prudent person when it came to arranging to be picked up or dropped off at places. She wasn't real fond of the dark, so she would usually make sure that she was home or at least at a safe location when night fell. This means that surely if Karen had made other arrangements that day to be picked up, she would have told her aunt. The sad part is that the last time Karen was seen was as she left her aunt's shoe store at about 2:45 p.m. She was actually last seen walking towards West Sonoma Street, but after that, she wasn't seen again. When Karen is reported missing and the public finds out, three different witnesses come forward with some information. They all had a similar story of seeing a girl matching Karen's description, speaking to a man in a blue car. One of the witnesses says the car pulled across Broadway Street and nearly hit him before stopping for the girl that matched Karen's description. Slight problem, the three witnesses had slightly different descriptions of the car. They all said it was light blue and four-door, year model between 1976 and 1978. They disagreed, however, on it being either a Ford Granada, a Mercury Monarch, or a Nissan. The vehicle did have a California license plate, and Eureka was imprinted on the rear plate's frame. Now, the witnesses all had a similar description of the driver of the car. He's described as a Caucasian male between 60 and 70 years old. They say he had balding, light gray or sandy blonde hair. He had green or gray eyes and a big nose that I guess was kind of crooked because they say it appeared to have been broken before. He had a small build and wore glasses as well. And the time he was seen, he was wearing a long sleeve button down light blue shirt. They were able to create a sketch of the driver and they also sketched the vehicle. The driver is wanted for questioning in Karen's case. Now they don't really know who this driver is, but as this investigation into the disappearance begins, they look at someone that this may be. This is where this case, or my telling of this case, may get a little complicated. In March of 1998, this man goes into Annie's shoes. So this is after Karen's disappearance. They notice that the man looks like the man in the sketch. They also realize eventually that he had been in the store while Karen was working more than once before her disappearance. But I think in those instances where he had met with Karen in the store before, he was actually dressed as a woman. It is a rumor that Karen and this man also volunteered at the same homeless shelter, and the possibility that these two had met and may have at least been familiar with each other is pretty good. So who is this man? Well, it's Robert Durst. I've talked about him before, if you remember, when I covered the disappearance of Lynn Scholes in Vermont, because he is also a suspect in her disappearance. That was episode 18 in Vermont that was published on May 6th of 2020. Her case is real interesting if you want to go back and listen to that episode just to refresh your memory. If you aren't familiar with Robert Durst, I'll give you a quick rundown. He is a real estate heir whose first wife, Kathleen Durst, went missing from New York in 1982. He is also considered a suspect in her disappearance. In 2001, he was charged with the homicide of a man named Morris Black. Morris Black was Durst's neighbor, and Black was murdered, dismembered, put into trash bags, and dumped into Galveston Bay. Durst claimed he killed Black in self-defense and dismembered him in a fit of confusion. In 2003, he was acquitted of the murder, but found guilty of tampering with evidence and sentenced to 3 years, I believe it was, in that case. In 2015, Durst was charged with the 2000 shooting death of Susan Berman in California. Durst and Berman were longtime friends, and in September of 2021, Durst was convicted of her murder. After this conviction, they decided to pursue the charges in his missing wife's case, so that is still ongoing, I believe. Now, his wife is not the only disappearance he is looked at for, as I had already mentioned. He is a suspect in Lynn Scholl's disappearance, and they also looked at him for the disappearance of a woman named Kristen Matafari in 1997. She disappeared from San Francisco. Some sources say, though, that Durst was ruled out as a suspect in her case. They did look at him as well for the Long Island serial murders, but they ruled him out as they could not make a connection between him and those victims. Durst is still a suspect in Karen's disappearance, but I don't believe that they have enough evidence to pursue charges against him at this point. He will most likely spend the rest of his life locked up, so we can only hope he somehow grows a conscience and reveals where Karen is, if he is indeed the person who abducted her. And I hope that he would have the same for Kristen Matafari and help her family as well. Searches did occur in Karen's case in the weeks that followed her disappearance, but they turned up no new information. A tip line was also set up after her disappearance, but tips showed slow to a stop after about a month. So if you do know anything about the disappearance of Karen Marie Mitchell, you can please contact the Eureka Police Department. So this may sound a little stupid or insensitive, but I am very excited to tell you about this next case. This is unlike any case I've covered before, because all of the information I have on this case is from a website dedicated to this case. Everything about this case and investigation is on the site. The site was created because this missing person's father wanted everything to be known for any future investigations. The website is chrisreward.org, and this is the disappearance of Christopher Robert Gioak. I think it's Gioak. It's G-I-A-U-Q-U-E. But I think it's pronounced Gioak, or at least that's how they said it was pronounced when I looked it up. Anyway, Chris is case number MP57686 in Namus. He isn't on the Doe Network, but that's probably more because he's a more recent case and the disappearance had occurred in 2003. So sometimes it's real hit and miss with the newer cases. Chris is a Caucasian male who stands between 6 foot and 6 foot two and weighed between 145 and 150 pounds. He has sandy blonde to brown hair, which was in 4 foot long dreadlocks at the time of his disappearance. He has blue eyes, and at the age of 4 and 16, Chris had open heart surgery, so there are scars in that location. At 27, Chris had a broken back. And a rod was inserted into his back, so he has a scar on his back as well. He was born on February 2nd of 1967 and was 36 at the time of his disappearance, and he would be 54 now. Chris was last seen wearing a hat, orange and or red Carhartt trousers, and two shirts. One was red, orange, and white. Hawaiian print, and the other shirt description is unknown. He was also wearing a wedding band with GRC 62603 engraved on it, but I don't know if that's necessarily true. We'll get into that in a minute. Chris may also use the alias James Anthony Beam. Now, this may get a little complicated because there are several names, but I'll try and cut out as many as I can. I need to tell you a bit about Chris before we start. Chris was an activist who promoted the legalization of marijuana for medical use. He had been arrested and jailed several times, and his home had been raided due to his involvement with the drugs, and he was on probation for marijuana cultivation at the time of his disappearance. He had actually just recently been released after a one-year sentence at the federal prison in Atwater, California, for the cultivation and distribution of marijuana. About 2 weeks before his disappearance, Chris got married. Now, the Charlie Project reported the engraving on his ring as 62603, but his actual wedding was reportedly on July 2603, which would make the engraving 72603. He married Rebecca Lynn Smiley in a large outdoor wedding in Trinidad, California on that day. So let's talk about Saturday, August 9th of 2003. Late that afternoon, Chris left his home in Solomon Creek, which is in Humboldt County. Chris drove south on Highway 101 to the Spy Rock region that is adjacent to Mendocino County. He was headed to meet a business associate named Benjamin Lomax. Lomax had a large sum of money for Chris, which was owed to Chris from income earned on a Spy Rock property while Chris was in prison. When Chris reached Spy Rock Road along Highway 101, he drove up Spy Rock Road, then Iron Peak Road, and parked his 1994 blue Toyota pickup at an area known as Government Pond. He met Lomax at this location around 7 p.m., and they were going to go together in Lomax's vehicle to the property. So this property, it was a pretty large property of more than 440 acres with three owners, Chris Lomax and Adrian Vasquez. Because Chris was on probation, he didn't want his vehicle seen on the property, which is why he parked it at the Government Pond. Obviously, there was a grow on this property, so Chris being there would violate his probation. Chris bought this property back in 1999 and had Lomax and Vasquez each put down $5,000. In return, Lomax and Vasquez each received 25% interest in the property. This was done so that hopefully it would deflect some attention away from Chris because of his previous arrests for cultivation and distribution. I guess Chris didn't feel like there was any issues that he was going to have to deal with going out there, because he usually traveled with his large Rottweiler, but he didn't bring him on this day. Obviously, he didn't have someone with him for this trip either. Now, because Chris was a felon, he couldn't have or carry a gun. He did, however, have a knife on him, which had a blade about 4 inches long. Lomax drove Chris from the Government Pond to the property, which was about 5 miles away. Once they arrived, they went inside a 20-foot trailer home located on the property to conduct business. Lomax would later tell police that they conducted their business and then he gave Chris a ride back to his truck. He said he last saw Chris as Chris was driving down the Iron Peak Road. Lomax said he drove up to the Iron Peak lookout area where cell phone reception was good, and there he made several phone calls. Chris was never seen again. On the afternoon of Monday, August 11th, Chris's wife, Rebecca, went to the Humboldt County substation in Garberville and reported Chris is missing. She didn't go by herself, though. She was accompanied by an attorney and Lomax, who was allegedly the last person to see Chris. Chris's brother, Clint, was informed that Chris was missing, and in turn, Clint informed their parents. On this day, Chris was reported missing. Chris's father spoke to Rebecca that evening. Chris's father called Rebecca the following day, presumably to get any updates. And during that phone call, Rebecca told him that upon the advice of her attorney, she would not have any further communications with him, and she allegedly has not spoken to him since. Let's talk about Chris's truck. His truck was apparently driven on the back roads of Mendocino and Humboldt County in an area north of his house in Salmon Creek. Late in the afternoon of Sunday, August 10th, the truck was driven down Elk Creek Road to Avenue of the Giants. At the intersection, the driver of Chris's truck got out of the vehicle traveling on the Avenue of the Giants. Chris's truck was being followed by a second truck, and the driver of Chris's truck turned left onto Avenue of the Giants. He drove several hundred feet and parked off of the road by some redwood trees. The driver then got out of Chris's truck and got into the second following truck, which was a full-size brown Ford pickup truck, year 1975 to 1980 model. The left brake light of this truck was covered with red tape. It also had pretty significant damage to the left-hand side, with damage to the driver's door all the way to the back bumper. The truck also had oversized off-road tires and was very dirty. On August 13th, the truck was located and it was towed to Garberville Sheriff's Substation, and then it was then towed to the Department of Justice in Eureka for forensic examination. Apparently, the truck was very clean and didn't have road dust on it. And this is odd because Chris apparently always had a messy truck. It is said that the truck must have been cleaned in the vicinity of either Dyerville Loop Road or Elk Creek Road. Several days after the truck was located, the person driving the vehicle that was cut off at that intersection looked at several mugshots provided by law enforcement. The witness was about 90% certain that the driver he saw was a guy named David Sequoia, aka David Gabriel Barger. David was apparently killed by law enforcement in March of 2010 in Eureka. I don't know the story there. I'm not sure what that is. So in case you didn't get it, apparently somebody was driving Chris's truck on those back roads to dump it, and they were being followed by another vehicle that was going to pick up the driver or whatever. But there was a witness, that witness that got cut off by Chris's truck, and that's why they could tell, or they knew that someone that wasn't Chris was driving that truck, because the witness had saw it and it stuck in his mind because he had been cut off, and that was at Avenue of the Giants. I know that it didn't come out very clear when I told it to you. That's why I just wanted to clarify. Now let's talk about some of the people of interest. Obviously, police are going to look at the business partner, Lomax, but Lomax hired an attorney for legal advice and to be with him during any interviews by law enforcement. Police do end up going to the Spy Rock property that was jointly owned, and they wanted to interview a group of four people after this. Those people are Scott McKinney, Freddie Delgado, Victor Suarez Jr., and Eric Barnett. Scott McKinney was contacted by law enforcement, and they were told to contact the attorney representing all four of the people. Freddie Delgado did split from the group and hired his own attorney and was interviewed by law enforcement. The other three people apparently were never interviewed by law enforcement about Chris's case. About 3 or 4 days after Chris's disappearance, two of Chris's friends went to the Spy Rock property to look for Chris. They ended up meeting Scott McKinney at a gate on Simmerly Road. And they noticed that McKinney had his left arm, bandaged up from his wrist to his elbow. McKinney claimed that he had accidentally injured himself cutting weed. McKinney let the two friends through the gate and they drove onto the property. Lomax wasn't on the property at this time, apparently, but Ben lived in a trailer. Ben Lomax lived in a trailer on the property from time to time. One of the friends went to the trailer. The trailer was usually pretty messy, and people actually referred to it as a pigsty. On this day, though, the trailer was different. It was cleaned, and it smelled of Clorox, which is odd. So let's talk about Scott McKinney. since he had that suspicious injury on his arm, I'm sure you are, you know, curious about what he may have to do with this. 1 year after Chris's disappearance, a private investigator was hired to look into the case. This private investigator went to several areas and left business cards because he was looking for Scott McKinney to make contact with him. Eventually, Scott McKinney did make contact with the private investigator, but he told him that he didn't know anything about what happened to Chris. The private investigator asked McKinney about the injury to his left arm, and McKinney claimed that it was the result of him injuring himself while cutting the bottoms of plastic pots. Obviously, this is a different story than the one he had told earlier. And the PI asked McKinney if he would be willing to sign a release on his medical records for the treatment of that injury. McKinney told the private investigator no, it would just open a can of worms, which is an odd statement to make. But now, a couple of years after Chris's disappearance, in a completely separate matter, four of the persons of interest in Chris's case were included in a federal indictment out of Fresno, California. This indictment of 15 people was for a large-scale conspiracy to cultivate and distribute 4,400 pounds of marijuana. Pursuant to the execution of search and arrest warrants in Mendocino County, agents arrested Freddie Delgado, Victor Suarez Jr., Ben Lomax, and Scott McKinney. And they all turned themselves into federal law enforcement in San Francisco. Lomax had already had multiple interviews about Chris's disappearance. As a consequence of this federal indictment, Lomax had to undergo a lengthy 3-hour interview during 2007. The Mendocino County Sheriff's Detective, who had been handling Chris's case, conducted the interview in 2007. This was the last interview of Lomax about Chris's case. It was the opinion of the interviewing deputy that Lomax had nothing to do with Chris's disappearance. On September 9th, 2010, an order that legally established the death of Chris was signed in Humboldt County Superior Court. Rebecca's attorney had Chris's death certificate purged and kept confidential except for estate and inheritance purposes. From now on, this is some pretty interesting things that come about. I think the start of it was the reward. In February of 2012, Chris's father established a reward fund of $200,000. On February 29th of 2012, an area newspaper published a letter to the editor written by none other than Scott McKinney. In the letter, McKinney claimed that he had nothing to do with Chris's disappearance and that he, too, wanted justice for Chris. He also claimed he was willing to contribute to the reward fund. Turns out, McKinney never contributed a single cent. Information published on the internet clearly shows a deep scar about 5 inches long on the outside of McKinney's left forearm. This cut was not self-inflicted, as McKinney would have you believe, but during the interviews with Lomax, he told law enforcement that McKinney was not injured the afternoon Chris went missing, but his arm was bandaged up a day later. In June of 2014, Chris's father, his name is Bob, received between 8 and 10 calls from someone who would not identify themselves. In the article, they give the phone number, but I'm not going to put it out there, on here at least. The area code, however, is 615, which apparently indicates it's from an area of Lower Tennessee or Upper Mississippi. The individual was calling from the Compcha area of Mendocino County. Now, what he tells Bob is interesting. The person said that he was present when Chris was killed and that he worked for Ben Lomax. He claimed there were 4 people present besides Chris and that it was a setup killing. He also said that Chris did not receive any money from Lomax. He named the 4 people as Lomax, McKinney, a person called Vic, but he doesn't know Vic's last name, and himself. The anonymous person said that Chris's knife, Chris knifed McKinney while being overpowered. He also claimed that McKinney received a very serious cut on his upper body. And he said Chris was killed with his own knife and McKinney had to seek medical attention after. He said Chris's body was wrapped in a tarp so that no blood would get into the vehicle used to transport his body off of the property. He said Chris's truck was driven and abandoned in Humboldt County to deflect investigation away from Spy Rock area. This person claimed to be very sorry that he was there when Chris was killed. He didn't know why Chris didn't drive out of the property in his own truck. Apparently, he was unaware of Chris's legal situation at the time. And the person was not seeking the reward money. He said he was very scared and asked that Bob buy a Green Dot with a Green Dot card with $224 on it for bus money so that he could travel to Mississippi. I don't think Bob is a dumb man. I just want to put that out there because it's going to become, there's going to be some question about it. So during their conversations, Bob would pepper in bits of incorrect information regarding two of the people that were allegedly present. He was doing this to ensure that this person was telling the truth. Each time that Bob threw out these bits of incorrect information, he was corrected by the person. And this person also knew very personal information about Ben Lomax. Now, Bob did purchase that Green Dot and called the person and provided them with the number on the card. This person was supposed to call Bob back and tell him where Chris's body was. The person never called back, and the phone was, of course, a burner, so they couldn't get anything from that. Apparently, law enforcement does not believe that this person was actually a witness to the crime, and they think that Bob was scammed for bus money, which I say, you know, $224, it's sure. I'll give you $224 if you can give me a little bit of information, even if it is wrong. If I had $224, if I had $224 to give you for bus fare, but either way. In 2018, a new private investigator was hired on a visit to Mendocino County with Bob. The private investigator was provided with a copy of the three-hour-long interview with Lomax that took place about 4 years after Chris's disappearance. The interview was then transcribed, and what was discovered was that multiple extremely important statements by Lomax that were actually untruths. They describe them as untruths, not lies. But anyway, those untruths were never checked out by the detective assigned to the case. This particular detective left the department in 2010 because of medical reasons, and he ended up starting his own private investigation business in 2020. He was hired to review that three-hour interview, and he was able to provide a small amount of additional information. He was, however, still of the opinion that Lomax had nothing to do with Chris's disappearance. In October of 2020, the reward was doubled. The sum of $200,000 is being offered for information that leads to Chris's recovery, and the additional $200,000 is being offered for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the person or persons responsible for his presumed homicide. The reward will only remain available through 2024. So I know that that was a lot of information, but if you have any information that could help solve this case, you can go to chrisreward.org. Plenty of options for contact there, or you can contact the Humboldt County Sheriff's Department. But I do want to remind you, if you are looking to get the whole whole $400,000, provide the information before 2024, and it has to be for the recovery of Chris's body and information that can lead to the conviction of the people involved. So I suggest going check out chrisreward.org just so you can review all the case material. They do have pictures of him. I find him very handsome. And I'm gonna give a big shout out to his dad, who's at absolutely doing the best that he can to get everything out there about his son and try and find his son. So that's chrisreward.org, or you can contact the Humboldt County Sheriff's Department with any information. So this next case is a case that I want to have more information about. I don't think there's a lot out there because I think some things are being worked below the public eye. This was originally a double disappearance, but it's not anymore, and we'll get into why. This is the disappearance of Michael William Desmet. He is case number MP85059 in Namus, but he's not on the DOE network. Michael is a Caucasian male, born on November 12th of 1971. He was 35 at the time of his disappearance, and he would be 50 now. He was 6'1" and 200 pounds with blonde hair and green eyes. On August 26th of 2005, Michael and 52-year-old Joseph Clarence Wilma Jr. left Humboldt County en route to Wilma's remote property in Covelo, California. They were in Joseph Wilma's maroon 1998 Toyota pickup with California license plate number 706-7771. Neither man was heard from again, and they were both reported missing. The disappearance of these men came shortly after law enforcement eradicated a large illicit marijuana garden on Wilma's Covelo property. On April 5th of 2007, almost 2 years later, Mendocino County Sheriff's Office was contacted by a person who had found a human jawbone. The bone was found on a secluded piece of wilderness near Wilma's property. The jaw still had some teeth in it, and the person that found the bone was just a hiker in the area. So they go out and they search the area, and they find Wilma's truck and a human femur bone. Now, they have to test these bones to find out who they belong to. There's a couple of options here, obviously. It's either Wilma's or it's Desmond's. They did apparently find some other bones in this area, but not much is said about those other than that they did not belong to Wilma. And presumably, they didn't belong to Desmond either. The jaw and the femur bone obviously belong to Wilma because I'm telling you about Desmet. The jaw and the femur bone had belonged to him, and no other bones belonging to him were found at that location, from what they say. They also did not find any indication of Michael at that scene or in that area. I have a couple of theories here. I think that they really didn't find any bones belonging to Michael, or that they found bones that they have not been able to identify yet as to who they belong to. So they're not really clear on those other bones and who they belong to, which makes me wonder if there's a possibility that there are some that belong to Michael Desmet. No, now, obviously, I guess Wilma isn't missing anymore technically, but he is still listed on Namus. I'm not going to give you that information just because I don't feel like there's a need to still look for him as a living person. They found a jawbone and a femur bone, and obviously, I don't think you can survive without those two things. But Namus, I've run across this issue with Namus in the past that unless they find almost a complete skeletal remain, that they won't generally take them off of the Namus database. Anyway, police theorized that both Michael and Joseph Wilma were murdered because of something to do with the illegal grow operation that was going on Wilma's property. The area that the bones were found in also had an illegal plot with about 4,500 plants when police went to the area to search for more bones after that jawbone was found. And then they discovered that plot and eradicated it. So, as I mentioned, police think that both men were murdered. But I say you allegedly only found proof of one dead man. So, what's to say that the one that is dead wasn't perhaps murdered or killed by the one that you can't prove is dead? I just feel like it's an option, like it would have or it should be in the first case that we covered for this episode, Barbara Kelly. But who really knows? I don't think they can say. We do know that, obviously, based on DNA, that Wilma is deceased, but Michael Desmet still hasn't been located. No one really knows for sure what actually happened, but there are, possibilities as to, what occurred out there in the wilderness. So if you have any information about the death of Joseph Clarence Wilma Jr. or the disappearance of Michael William Desmet, please contact either Humboldt County Sheriff's Office or Mendocino County Sheriff's Office. So this case should be pretty short, but I did find it really interesting. Let's get into the disappearance of Kawika David Benjamin Chetron. I think it's pronounced Chetron. If I am butchering that last name, I am sorry. He is not on Namus or the Doe Network, and the only place I found this case was on the Charley Project. Kawika was born on December 7th of 1974. He was 32 at the time of his disappearance, and he would be 47 now. He is 5'9" and 150 pounds. He is a Caucasian male with red hair and brown eyes. Now, Kawika may be his legal first name, though that is how I did find him. His father says that Kawika, which is spelled Kawika, means David in Hawaiian, and he acquired that name as a child. So I'm not sure what's on his birth certificate, but I do know that it was more difficult to find David Chetron than it was Kawika De Chetron, and he's pretty much known by Kawika when we get into what his life is. I don't want to tell you what he was wearing just yet, although we have an idea. I do want to tell you, however, a little bit about his background. Kawika was born in San Anselmo, California. His family moved a lot when Kawika was a child. At school age, his family located for a second time to Marion County, and they lived there until Kawika was in secondary school. This was the second time that they had lived in Marin County. They moved a lot. I'm not 100% sure why, but I guess they liked it in Marin County, which is why they ended up there more than once. In Marin County, Kawika got his first experience at scuba, and there was some initial difficulties with cold water diving, but past that, Kawika had found a fascination with scuba diving. Kawika went to boarding school for high school at Robert Louis Stevenson School. Although the school was close to beautiful dive sites, Kawika didn't do much diving in high school. But after boarding school, Kawika went to college for engineering at Harvard and Stanford. Upon graduating college, Kawika had more time to dive than in 2004, he got his first underwater camera. Then a whole new passion began. In 2007, Kawika worked at Cisco Systems in Silicon Valley and was an underwater photographer operating the website Coldwater Images. On Friday, March 16th, 2007, Kawika left Cisco Systems, got into his truck, and headed north. He was towing his dive boat, which was a 17-foot Boston Whaler named Rapture. Saturday morning, he pulled into the public docks in Eureka and set off south for Blunt's Reef, 24 miles down the Pacific Coast. It was a formation of rocks and sea pinnacles 5 miles out of Cape Mendocino, and Kawika was alone on this excursion, but he never returned. Here is where I tell you he was believed to be wearing a dry suit with a double liner and dark colored diving gear.
Now, Koika had been diving since 1986, so he was well experienced. He was also a strong swimmer and very fit. The water temperature at the time of his disappearance was about 55 degrees, and the sea was calm, and he was dressed appropriately for those conditions. When Koika didn't return from his dive, the Coast Guard was contacted, and the day after his disappearance, the Coast Guard located his boat. The boat was half submerged, awash on and anchored in about 100 feet of water near Blunt's Reef. His camera was still on board. The Coast Guard searched for Kawika for 2 nights and days, and after that, he was listed as lost and presumed drowned. So that's it. That's the disappearance of Kawika Chetron. If you have information that may help locate him, you can contact the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office. And if you want to check out some of his photography, I believe his website is still up. You can search his name, Kawika Chetron, and one of the very first things that pops up is the website with all his photography, his cold water photography on it. It's quite interesting, actually. And I had never heard about this case, but his photography is quite great. So I suggest going check that out. And if you know any information, maybe reach out to the Humboldt County Sheriff's Department so that, he could be located. This next case I had actually heard about before. I'm pretty sure I heard it on a podcast, although I'm not sure which one. I do listen to several different ones, so I can't pinpoint which one it was. This is the bizarre disappearance of Christine Lindsay Walters. She is case number MP5477 in Namus, and she is not on the Doe Network. Christine was born on August 8th of 1985. She was 23 at the time of her disappearance and would be 36 now. She stood between 5'2" and 5'4" and weighed between 100 and 115 pounds. She had blondish red hair and had blue eyes. Her left nostril was pierced and her ears were pierced multiple times. She had a small black butterfly tattoo on her lower front hip and a large tattoo of a purple and green iris flower on the nape of her neck. She may use the names Airy Meadow, Airy Star, Meadow, and R Star. She was possibly last seen wearing a sweatshirt. She was surely wearing a hospital-issued pink pajama bottom and some Crocs, although they don't say what color those Crocs were. So Christine was living in Deerfield, Wisconsin in 2008, and she was a junior at the University of Wisconsin at Stevens Point, where she studied botany and ethnobotany. In July of 2008, Christine decided to take a trip to Portland, Oregon. The plan was for her to stay for 3 weeks before returning home. Those plans changed, though. Instead, Christine decided to extend her trips, perhaps indefinitely, and she decided not to go back to school for the fall semester. She met some friends on her trip and decided to go stay with them in Eureka, California. Once arriving in California, it seemed like things began to change with Christine. She became interested in spirituality, alternative lifestyles, and environmental causes. Also, before getting to California, Christine stayed in regular contact with her parents. Once she got to California, communication became less and less. She wasn't working consistently either, so she would have to ask her parents for money. So, her father had sent her $1,000 before her disappearance, but it was untouched in her bank account, between the time he sent it and the time she disappeared. On the morning of November 12, 2008, Christine was found naked, bloodied from briar scratches, and bruised on the doorstep of a home on the outskirts of Eureka. The homeowner contacted police when they found her there. She was frightened and claimed that someone was out to get her and they would find her wherever she went. At that time, though, Christina would not say what happened to her that caused these injuries. She later told her mother that she had been to hell and back and had seen demons while running through the woods. Part of those injuries Christine had was that her feet were almost raw from running. Police decided that Christine needed to go to the hospital to have her injuries checked out. She was brought to St. Joseph's Hospital, and once at the hospital, Christine did not want to be touched, and she wouldn't allow herself to get physically close to people. So, me too, girl. Anyway, Christine was evasive about what happened to her. She said she didn't want to talk much because the demons who were out to get her could hear what she was saying. So, are you thinking that this is drug-induced? Because, honestly, initially, I did too. Well, they were somehow able to test her for drugs, but it showed that she was negative for drugs. Well, the most common drugs. Let's be clear here, because we're going to find out what really happened, or what they believe really happened. So, police, I'm assuming, feel like this is a mental health issue, and they don't detain her. They don't have any reason to. They just want to get her help. They take her to a hotel so that she would be somewhat safe, at least. And they take her to the Red Line Hotel in Eureka. She spoke to her parents once she arrived at the hotel. Actually, she spoke to her mother several times. And her mother wanted her to stay at the hotel until Christine was able to get back home. She made arrangements with her parents to fly home, but the problem was that Christine had lost all of her identification and needed to get new documents before she could travel. Her mother offered to go to California to pick her up, but Christine said that she was a big girl and she would be fine. Her mother now regrets that she didn't go out there to get her. On November 14th, Christine went to a coffee center to pick up some papers her mother had faxed her to help her get her new ID. Employees at the coffee center said Christine appeared nervous and paranoid and even tried to hide the papers that she had. This was the last time Christine was actually seen. She was reported missing 3 days later on November 17th. After her disappearance, Christina's backpack, money, and ID were found at a spirituality center in Arcata. She would often leave her belongings there when she went for walks in the Arcata community forest. So Christine's family hires a private investigator at some point. He provides some clarification as to why Christine may have been acting the way that she was. He found out that Christine had been involved in a tea ceremony 1 week before she disappeared. These tea ceremonies are illegal in the U.S. In these ceremonies, participants drink ayahuasca, which I think is how you say it, which contains two drugs. Harmine, which is legal in the U.S., and DMT, which is considered a controlled substance and therefore illegal. Ingesting ayahuasca causes vomiting, diarrhea, and hallucinations that last up to 10 hours. It has been known to cause adverse reactions, including episodes of depression or mania in some people who are predisposed to mental illness. Now, obviously, we don't know for sure if her participation in the tea ceremony caused her disappearance or the events that transpired beforehand. After this tea ceremony, Christine apparently stayed in Arcata for several days with some of the people she participated in the ceremony with. She left on November 11th, and the next day, or the next morning, she was found naked on that doorstep about 20 miles away, which is why her feet were raw. Christine had obviously had previously taught Pilates and yoga and had also worked on an organic farm. So if she's around, she may be doing something along those lines. But if you have any information about the disappearance or the whereabouts of Christine Lindsay Walters, please contact the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office and let's find her and get her some help. So this case I wanted to tell you because it teaches a lesson, I believe. It'll be pretty short because this is one of those cases where we are pretty sure about, you know, what happened. Let's talk about the disappearance of Gregory James Kulgian. I think it's Kulgian. The only place I found this was on the Charlie Project, which means it's our second case in this episode with No Namus and No Doe. Gregory is a Caucasian male born on September 6th of 1996. He was 16 at the time of his disappearance and would be 25 now. Now, although he was only 16, I could not find an NCMEC for him. He was 6 foot tall and 140 pounds with brown hair and blue eyes. He is of Armenian descent and he was last seen wearing a black shirt and gray jeans. On November 24th of 2012, Gregory's family decided to spend the day at the beach. They headed to Big Lagoon County Park in Humboldt County, and the group consisted of Gregory, his girlfriend, his older sister Olivia, and their parents Mary and Howard, and the family dog Fran. Seems like it's going to be a good day, right? About 12:50 p.m., and everyone is enjoying their day. They are throwing a stick into the water for the dog, Fran, to go and fetch. The dog goes to fetch the stick, and a 10-foot swell overpowers the dog, and it starts sweeping the dog up. Gregory sees this and runs into the water to save Fran. He gets into the water, which was only about calf deep, and grabs the dog's collar, but the collar slips off, and Gregory is being swept up by the water now. Gregory's dad runs into the water to save his son because he sees what's going on, and he begins getting swept up by the waves. Now, Gregory's mom jumps in and tries to pull her husband and her son ashore, but she too ends up being swept in. Olivia runs in next and tries to save her mom, but she was getting swept away before a bystander rescued her and pulled her out. People call 911, and the first person to show up was a park ranger. He had to park about a half a mile up beach and then travel on foot because of the steep terrain around the beach. When he finally gets to the area, he pulls the mother out of the water and he begins CPR until other personnel arrives. They located the dad on shore a little further down the beach. He was already deceased. The mother never makes it off of the beach alive either, so both the father and the mother are deceased. They search for Gregory by air and water for the next 2 days, but they never located his body. They believe that Gregory drowned, and even if he hadn't drowned in those events, he could not have survived in the frigid water of the following days. Want to know the happy ending, yet the real fucked up part? When the mother ran into the water to try and save her husband and her son, Fran, the dog that kind of started this all, walked out of the water. The dog survived and was perfectly fine. Just walked off of the beach. So the mother's name is Mary Elena Scott, and the father's name is Howard Gregory Kulgian. The last name is spelled K-U-L-J-I-A-N. Although sometimes I see it misspelt, which is why I have the difficulty pronouncing it from time to time, but it's Kulgian, I believe. The surviving daughter is Olivia Kulgian, who was 18 at the time of these events. I didn't give the whole names earlier because I didn't want it to be too confusing. But if you wanted to look this whole situation up, those are the full names you can look it up by. Gregory's body still has not been recovered. So if you have any information about where he may be located, Humboldt County Sheriff's Department is the point of contact for this case. All right, we're on the last case for this episode. And this case, this final case for this episode, is one with a Louisiana connection. This disappearance occurred in 2014, and I vaguely remember it. Some of my Louisiana people may also remember this case because it was on social media pretty heavily at the time. This is the disappearance of Jeffrey Keith Joseph. He is case number MP25279 in Namus and case number 5349 DMCA in the Doe Network. Jeffrey is a Caucasian male born on February 4th of 1969. He was 45 at the time of his disappearance and 52 now. He is between 6'1" and 6'3" and he was about 200 pounds. He has graying hair and brown or hazel-colored eyes. He is mostly bald with sideburns and hair on the back of his head towards his neck. They're not sure what he was last seen wearing, but it is known that, you know, Jeff usually wore a hat. Jeff was last seen in Humboldt County on June 20th of 2014. He was driving a green 1998 Toyota RAV4 with Louisiana license plate number XMZ062, that's X-ray Mike Zulu 062, and a Louisiana State University or LSU sticker in the back window. That vehicle has still not been located either. So vehicle with Louisiana license plate and a disappearance in Humboldt County. Let's connect some dots here, okay? So Jeff is a Louisiana resident, although I could not find exactly where, but I do remember reading something at some point that pointed out exactly where he was from or where he was living, because I don't think he's from Louisiana. I think he was living there for a period of time. Now, Jeff lived in Louisiana, but he had business dealings in California, Los Angeles area, to be more specific. And he had had those connections for quite some time before his disappearance. Jeff was in the marijuana business. So Jeff left his uncle's house in Chatsworth on June 20th. Presumably, this is the last time he was actually seen by anyone who would admit that they saw him. He was planning to visit a farm in Humboldt County. Some sources say he was leasing this property. Some sources say he was going there to make a business transaction. It may have been one, it may have been both, it may have been neither. We're not really sure. It is still problematic that he is doing this because in 2010, he was arrested and charged with selling marijuana illegally in a marijuana dispensary that he owned in Delray area of Los Angeles. He pled guilty and was sentenced to 1 year in jail and 5 years on probation. So in 2014, he was still on probation. And part of that probation was that he could not sell, serve, store, keep, manufacture, cultivate, or give away marijuana. So he had to stay completely clear of it. He was most likely doing those things anyway, but he shouldn't have been, obviously. This farm that he was going to was, you know, a farm or an area of land where they were growing. Now, let's talk about his cell phone. The cell phone tells a lot to investigators. His phone records show cell tower pings that are consistent with him driving up I-5 on the 20th and then stopping in Sacramento for some time. Then later the tower records show a ping near Williams, but they don't know which route he took to get to that point. Jeff then made a call to an acquaintance on the East Coast at about 7:30 a.m. on the 21st, and shortly after that, he texted a friend in Louisiana. The acquaintance that he called said that Jeff told him he had driven all night from Southern California
and he seemed in good spirits. And Jeff told him he was killing time waiting to meet up with someone. The next and final ping from Jeff's phone is at 11:20 a.m. on the 21st, and the ping was off a Bloody Camp cell tower. This is in Hoopa, and this tower is about 20 miles from where Jeff was heading, and it provides coverage for a pretty large area. After that, there was no more activity on or from Jeff's cell phone. Jeff ends up missing a flight back to Louisiana at some point after that, and that's when people begin to worry. Some sources say that that flight was on the 21st, so later that day, but I've also seen it said that the flight was not until July 1st. And there's a big difference between, you know, the 21st of June and July 1st. That's a long period of time, so I don't know which version is true. Both Jeff and the vehicle are still missing, and it is believed that he may be in the Hoopa area because foul play is highly suspected in this case. So if you know anything about the disappearance of Jeffrey Keith Joseph, please contact the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office or the Los Angeles Police Department. They both have reports on file for this case. And it started off in Los Angeles because that's where they thought he was last located, or Los Angeles County. I'm not sure. But it started off with one and ended up to the other, but they both hold files on it. I think they work in unison in relation to this case. So you can call either, or, you know, you can call local law enforcement to provide any information that you have. So that is all 10 cases that I'm going to cover in this part one episode of California, and specifically this is Humboldt County. I do have two more parts to California that I'm going to do, and I was really going to get them out in a rush, but I've been so set back by being sick. I'm still struggling now, my throat is really irritated, if you can't tell, just from recording this, but I wanted to make sure I got something out to you because it had been so long, and I didn't want to get into a rut. I'm going to try, and I'm making no promises, but I'm going to try and get part two out a week from now. But honestly, it might be longer. So if you would just have some patience and bear with me, because I don't know what I'll be able to do if I progressively get sick, which I'm afraid might happen. But thank you for sitting and listening to part one. I want to thank you, everyone, for your continued support and continuing to listen. If you haven't done so already, please go follow, like, rate, and or review on whatever platform it is that you listen on. Apple Podcasts, those reviews, go ahead and give me 5 stars if you don't mind, because those really climb me up the chart. And I'm trying to get up there this year. That is one of several of my 2022 goals, is to grow this podcast in an extreme manner. I want this podcast most specifically to be known. So if you would go ahead and give me those reviews, help me climb up that chart and make my 2022 goal an actual possibility. You could also help by, you know, sharing this podcast with your friends, letting them know, you know, that this is a good podcast. If you dig it, if you don't dig it, just tell people about it. I really, really would appreciate that, 'cause I like doing this. I know sometimes I fall a little bit behind, but sometimes I just really can't help it. And I do apologize for that. I'm really trying as hard as I can to get these episodes out to you as quickly as possible. So thank you for continuing to support me and to listen. Like I mentioned before, I've got some pretty big things planned for this podcast in 2022. And we're gonna kick it off in a good way. I got, you know, hopefully some guests coming on to talk about some things. And we're gonna get it rolling out good this year. I know that I slacked a bit when I had to, you know, stop producing the podcast for a while because of other
circumstances, but I do continue, do thank you for continuing to listen. See, I'm sorry. my throat's starting to bother me, so it's hard for me to speak, but just, if you would, just go like, favorite, rate, and or review on whatever platform you listen on. Thank you for continuing to listen. Stay tuned for part two and part three in California. This is one of the biggest states, or it is the biggest state I've done to date, so we got to break it up in three parts. I'm sorry. But hopefully it'll be cases that you'll like hearing about. So thanks for listening. Please continue to listen. Please, and thank you for everything that you have done thus far. Let's make 2022 a huge year for State of Missing. And I will see you on the next episode. Bye.